The time is now. Volume 8, Episode 142. This is Employment Law Now, and I am Mike Schmidt, your host of the podcast and the Vice Chair of the Labor and Employment Department here at Cozen O'Connor. We are here toward the end of April 2024, and as I feel like I say every episode, so much has been going on in the world of labor and employment law. But there have been periods when one of our federal agencies, especially in this current active regulatory climate, takes some newsworthy, noteworthy action that affects employers and employees. But when multiple agencies do important stuff at the same time, well, that warrants a podcast episode devoted solely to agency action. It also warrants, in this particular case, a two-part series updating the most recent developments at our agency level. That's what you're getting starting today. The ABCs of agency action. I'm going to give you an update in today's part one, as well as later this week in part two, what's going on of significance at some of our federal agencies. This two-part episode is brought to you by the letters D, E, F, and O. I can't imagine that I am really dating myself with that sort of Sesame Street reference, but there I am. In any event, let's start part one, and we'll start with the letter D for the Department of Labor, the U.S. Department of Labor, the DOL. We've talked somewhat recently about changes that the Department of Labor was planning to make to the overtime exception regulations. Looks like we're about to get some significant movement here for the first time since last December, when the DOL told us it was likely coming in the spring of 2024. Because here we are in the spring of 2024. Remember, as a matter of federal law, in order to be exempt for purposes of minimum wage and overtime under the FLSA, you essentially need to be able to prove two buckets. The first bucket, there has to be a minimum threshold salary amount. And the second bucket, there has to be a job duties test. As the Department of Labor's final rule is about to be announced, we're still not expecting any changes to the job duties tests, whether it's for the executive exemption, the administrative exemption, or the professional exemption, the major white-collar exemptions. We're not expecting changes to the job duties test, so we can still expect there to be the same kind of litigation that we have seen over the past few decades on that issue. But we are expecting there to be an increase, we'll see if it's significant or not, to the minimum salary threshold. We still don't know. The details have not been made public just yet. But last year in 2023, the Department of Labor proposed to increase the minimum annual salary threshold from the current $35,568 to $55,068, a significant increase. The rule, as proposed last year, also proposed automatic future updates every 3 years. The final rule will have to be published in the Federal Register before it can take effect. Again, the Department of Labor last year projected that the rule was going to be published in the spring of 2024, and here we are. We don't know if the minimum salary threshold will stay at $55,068 as proposed, or when it will ultimately be effective. But we are waiting. We are waiting because the new proposed final rule has passed White House review. So we are probably just days away from getting that released. And when it does get released, we will be all over it. And we will explain to you what has been proposed. We'll explain to you what has not been proposed. And we'll also talk about the possible challenges, because once it is published in its final form, the final rule is very likely to be the subject of court challenge, as it has been in prior years when there has been a proposed change to the exemptions. It may not matter, as we've also said, it may not matter if you are in states like New York, for example, where the minimum salary threshold is already higher than that number, that proposed number. But in other states where that's not the case, it may be significant. And depending on where the number falls out, employers are going to have to prepare. They're going to have to make decisions as to whether we're going to increase the salary of some of those individuals who have been classified as exempt in order to maintain their exempt status. Or, on the other hand, if you don't want to increase to the new threshold for some exempt employees, you'll now have to reclassify them as non-exempt and then deal with the implications of that, whether that's making sure they're not working 40 hours or more than 40 hours in a week, or monitoring more closely the hours they are working so you can accurately do your record keeping and accurately pay them. So again, we're probably days away from getting the DOL's new final rule, and we'll let you know when that happens. On to the letter E for the EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. You will remember that in back in June 2023, the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act, the PWFA, became effective. The purpose of the act was essentially to fill in the perceived gaps in coverage of the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act, and the Federal Pregnancy Discrimination Act, by now requiring that covered employers provide a reasonable accommodation for pregnancy, childbirth, and other related conditions, regardless of whether one suffered from a condition that would rise to the level of a disability under the ADA, and regardless of whether there is discriminatory treatment between the individual needing the accommodation and another individual who is not suffering from a pregnancy-related condition. We've all been waiting for the EEOC to issue its final guidance. And last week, on April 15th, 2024, the EEOC did just that, clarifying the scope and definitions in the PWFA, as well as clarifying a little bit on employers' obligations under the PWFA. In terms of process and where we are procedurally, the EEOC's final guidance is expected to be officially published in the Federal Register, and then it will become effective 60 days later on June 18th, 2024. More than 100,000 comments were received and reviewed by the EEOC after the EEOC published its proposed rule last summer. More than 100,000 comments. I'm guessing the EEOC, like many employers, would prefer not to have a suggestion box if it had its druthers, but that is the process. There is a permitted public comment period, and that's what they got, a lot of comments. So again, absent any kind of legal challenge that stays the effective nature of these, the final guidance and the final rule from the EEOC on the PWFA will become effective on June 18th, 2024. So what does the EEOC's final guidance tell us? Well, it tells us a lot because the final rule is more than 400 pages. So there's a lot in there. But in some respects, it is also kind of simple. What you need to understand is that the EEOC, as you would expect, given the current majority, has retained the expansive reading and the expansive interpretation of the applicable terms. So when the Act requires or refers to pregnancy, childbirth, or related medical conditions, again, the EEOC is interpreting those terms in a very broad fashion to include things like current pregnancy, past pregnancy, potential pregnancy, menstruation, infertility and fertility treatments, conditions such as miscarriage or stillbirth, or somebody having an abortion or deciding not to have an abortion. Again, a very expansive reading of the kinds of conditions that would be covered and therefore would permit an individual to request an accommodation. There is no requirement, as the EEOC has also confirmed, that any of the conditions rise to some particular severity threshold. It doesn't matter if the condition is severe or not in order to permit an individual to request an accommodation under the PWFA. Now, even though you are, as an employer, I suspect, used to the process under the ADA when individuals with a covered disability request an accommodation and go through that interactive process, the PWFA is a little bit different. Let me give you a couple of examples. Under the PWFA, an individual can request an accommodation which could include temporarily holding off on a particular essential job function. Remember, under the ADA, it is not deemed reasonable for somebody to ask for an accommodation when it comes to an essential job function. But under the PWFA, a worker can seek a temporary suspension of an essential job function, and they would still be covered under this new act. As long, however, as that person who is asking for a temporary suspension of an essential job function, as long as that person is expected to be able to perform the suspended essential job function in the near future, again, another term of art, and as long as the employer can reasonably accommodate that individual's temporary inability to perform the particular essential function. So if after going through the dialogue and going through the process, there is no reasonable accommodation that can be had that includes the temporary suspension of the individual's essential job function, then the individual is no longer qualified under the PWFA and is not entitled to an accommodation under that statute. The PWFA also does retain the ADA's notion of an undue hardship. So if temporarily suspending an essential job function would cause an undue hardship to the employer, and again, it's the employer's burden to prove that, then the individual also would not be entitled to an accommodation under the PWFA. Among the other things that the EEOC has now done in its final rule, it has provided a non-exhaustive list of some examples of reasonable accommodations. Many of these are self-explanatory, many of these are obvious, and many of these do track what accommodations might be deemed reasonable under the ADA. Allowing a covered individual to sit or stand despite requirements to the contrary. Scheduling changes, remote work, light duty, the ability to have certain preferred parking, job restructuring, additional or modified equipment or policies in some cases, frequent breaks. And what's interesting about the final rule as well is the EEOC did not just provide this non-exhaustive list of accommodations that might be deemed reasonable on a case-by-case basis, but the EEOC went further and provided four different accommodations that it believed was de facto reasonable in all cases, that the EEOC would presume that these particular four accommodations are reasonable and would not impose an undue hardship in virtually all cases. There is an opportunity to treat that as a rebuttable presumption, but it will be the burden of the employer, and I suspect it'll be a tough burden, to prove that in a particular case, these four sort of de facto accommodations are either not reasonable or would impose an undue hardship. What are those four? One, permitting an employee to carry water or drink water or other beverages as needed in or nearby the employee's work area. Two, permitting the employee to take additional restroom breaks as may be needed. Three, permitting the employee who is required to sit to be able to stand as needed, or someone who is required to stand to be able to sit as needed. And four, permitting an employee to take breaks as needed to eat and or to drink. Again, there is a rebuttable presumption, the EEOC says, that those four are sort of de facto reasonable and de facto will not cause an undue hardship. What are the prohibited practices under the PWFA, according to the EEOC? Failure to provide reasonable accommodations to a covered individual. Forcing an employee or an applicant to accept an accommodation that the employer demands but is not necessarily desired by the employee. Denying equal employment opportunities to the covered individual in comparison to others who do not suffer from the same condition. And of course, taking retaliatory action against somebody for either asking or for utilizing a reasonable accommodation that has been requested. This has not gone without any controversy. EEOC Commissioner Andrea Lucas, who you all know as a frequent guest of this podcast, came out very vocally in opposition to what the majority of the EEOC commissioners published as its final rule last week. First, she posted on LinkedIn, and I want to read this because it's interesting, not just for the substantive position that Commissioner Lucas took, but again, just looking at the dynamic of the workings of the EEOC commissioners. You don't typically see this kind of public debate between commissioners like this at the EEOC. But so Commissioner Lucas posted the following. Today, and I'm quoting, today the EEOC issued its final rule implementing the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act. I voted to disapprove the final rule. My full 16-page statement addressing my vote is attached to this post. The statement can be downloaded from this post for further review. She continues, in short, I support elements of the final rule. However, I was unable to approve it because it purports to broaden the scope of the statute in ways that, in my view, cannot reasonably be reconciled with the text. At a high level, the rule fundamentally errs in conflating pregnancy and childbirth accommodation with accommodation of the female sex, that is, female biology and reproduction. The Commission extends the new accommodation requirements to reach virtually every condition, circumstance, or procedure that relates to any aspect of the female reproductive system. And the results are paradoxical. Worse, the Commission chose not to structure the final rule in a manner that realistically allows for severability of its objectionable provisions from its reasonable and rational components. Finally, Commissioner Lucas says, the PWFA was a tremendous bipartisan legislative achievement. Pregnant women in the workplace deserve regulations that implement the Act's provisions in a clear and reliable way. It is unfortunate that the elements of the final rule serving this purpose are inextricably tied to a needlessly expansive foundation that does not. I cannot support the Commission's final product. End quote. a very interesting and, as I said, very vocal opposition from the minority at the EEOC to what the majority voted to approve as the final rule that, again, will become effective in June. I have two real immediate takeaways beyond the obvious that employers really need to get their heads wrapped around the requirements here, because they've spent so much time learning the ADA interactive process. In states that have their own state version of the ADA, gotten their heads wrapped around what those nuances may be. But here we now have the Federal Pregnant Workers Fairness Act with its implementing final rule that will be effective in June. And employers and those who are involved in the process of dealing with accommodation requests need to understand the nuances of this particular federal law. But I've got two other immediate takeaways from what the EEOC just did. Number one, the majority of commissioners that did vote to adopt this final rule under the current Biden administration, not surprisingly, took a very extremely broad and expansive view of the PWFA. Litigation is certain to arise involving the EEOC's interpretation and guidance here. Regardless, when employers are looking to err on one side or the other, they need to keep in mind how the EEOC is likely to look at particular circumstances involving requests for accommodations under the PWFA. And that leads me to takeaway number two. We are still waiting for a monumental decision from the United States Supreme Court on whether this Supreme Court will dial back its Chevron deference doctrine. And that refers to past precedent, which essentially said that courts should provide deference to the rules and agencies, the rules and the interpretations and the regulations that are created by agencies who are in place to implement such rules, regulations, and guidance. But the amount of deference to be afforded to agencies has been heavily debated in recent years, and the Supreme Court is now about to issue a decision that will either maintain the same amount of deference we've been used to, or may, as many people predict, dial back that deference. Once that decision comes down, we'll have a better sense of how much weight federal courts in litigation before them will give to the EEOC's very broad and expansive interpretive guidance of the PWFA. We will continue to stay on top of this for all of you, but in the meantime, as I said, make sure you understand what the new obligations and the nuances are in the PWFA. We turn to the letter F for FTC, the Federal Trade Commission. You know, we talked about the FTC when they went a little bit outside their typical lane and weighed in a big way on the nationwide trend toward disfavoring non-competes. And by big way, I mean trying to ban them completely. It's hard to believe that it's almost been a year and a half, but in early January 2023, you will remember that the FTC issued a notice of proposed rulemaking that would ban employers from demanding non-competes from their employees and any other type of worker, including independent contractors. The proposed rulemaking also would retroactively void all existing non-competes and essentially require employers to rescind existing non-competes. No exceptions. No exception for high salary earners. No exceptions for the sale of goodwill in the context of the sale of a business. Not surprisingly, after that proposed rulemaking came out, tens of thousands of comments were submitted to the FTC during the public comment period, and we have all been waiting to see what the FTC would do with those comments. Well, the FTC has not announced their proposed final rule just yet, but last week, On April 16th, one day after the EEOC issued its final rule, the FTC announced that tomorrow, Tuesday, April 23rd, at 2 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time, how exciting is this? The FTC will hold a special open meeting to vote on their proposed final rule. Again, they have not issued it yet, but tomorrow, April 23rd at 2 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time, the FTC will have a special open meeting to vote on what is their proposed final rule. Presumably, the FTC will also actually announce or disclose what that proposed final rule will be during the meeting, if not immediately before. We don't really know at the moment if the final rule will remain in the same form as the FTC initially proposed over a year ago, or if it will be modified based on comments. We do know, though, that if the FTC votes tomorrow to approve the issuance of its final rule, there will unquestionably be immediate litigation challenging it on various grounds, not the least of which is whether the FTC had the authority to implement this final rule banning non-competes. And the immediate litigation will likely seek to enjoin its implementation immediately. Indeed, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce has already noted that it intends to file a lawsuit as soon as a final rule is issued. So, we will also keep you posted on what the final rule is, what the vote is during tomorrow's meeting, and the nature of litigation that will undoubtedly follow. If you are interested in the 2 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time hearing tomorrow, April 23rd, you're entitled to watch it. It is open to the public at ftc.gov. That address again is ftc.gov. In the meantime, don't take your eyes off what states are doing on this non-compete issue, as an increasing number of them are passing their own laws, either banning non-competes outright or severely curtailing their enforceability. So, in under a half hour, we just did part one of our big agency update, handling the letters D, E, and F. That leaves us with O. And you're going to get O later this week in part two of our agency update with a special guest helping me out for that one. Until the next time, I hope all of your labor is productive.
Important love.